This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The United States Supreme Court on Monday made a series of decisions that left many Americans reeling to make sense of them. First and most shockingly, all nine justices unanimously handed Donald Trump a victory on his controversial Muslim ban that so many lower courts had repudiated. Justices decided to let parts of the ban take effect until the court is to hear the case against it in the fall. The court also agreed to hear a case of a Colorado bakery that said it had the right to refuse service to a gay couple on the basis of the owner's religious rights. And the court issued a ruling in favor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Missouri to receive tax funds to restore a playground on its property. All three issues touch on a central tenet of American democracy, the separation of church and state. My guest is Barry Lynn, executive director of the group Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Welcome to the program, Barry.
It's nice to be back.
So let's tackle these issues one by one. First was a decision to allow the implementation of the ban that Donald Trump once called a Muslim ban, then called a travel ban, until the court picks it up and actually rules on it rather later this year. I was shocked that this was a unanimous decision that the court decided on its own to do instead of simply letting lower court rulings stand. Where did this come from?
I think it came out of a sense that the Supreme Court is moving more and more in an ultra-conservative direction. This doesn't mean that there will be a unanimous decision in October when they actually hear this case on the merits, but it certainly demonstrates, among other things, that the newest member of the court, Neil Gorsuch, formerly of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals out in the Dakotas and other parts of the western part of the United States, is as conservative as many of us feared he was and believed that the evidence was clear. He is proven to be, if it is possible, even more conservative than his predecessor, the late Justice Antonin Scalia. There's a lot of controversy, particularly from right-wing circles, that say, well, the fact that Donald Trump called this a Muslim ban during the campaign or called it that much later really is irrelevant. It is not irrelevant. It is exactly what courts have always done. Look at the intentions behind the acts. When he has six countries, predominantly Muslim countries, he decides that this ban, as he has repeatedly called it, should go into effect. When he made insulting remarks, as he did during the presidential campaign, like, it's hard to tell the difference between Muslims and terrorists. I think every common sense person understands that this is a statement of his intent, and his intent is to keep refugees and tourists from these six countries as far away from the shores of the United States as possible, as long as possible.
Well, Barry, okay, we can lay some blame on Neil Gorsuch, but Gorsuch shouldn't have the power to twist the arms of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of Sonia Sotomayor, of Justice Kennedy and others. Why did they sign off on this? It was a 9-0 decision to allow for the implementation of, partial implementation of the ban. They didn't even have to do that. They could have said they'll decide to actually hear the case, but they're allowing part of it to be implemented. That is, in some sense, a Supreme Court confirmation of the substance of this ban, a stamp of approval.
Well, absolutely. And of course, Donald Trump immediately characterized it as that way, a great victory for him. And although it doesn't reach the merits on the whole kit and caboodle of this ban, it is a very strong signal that there are a lot of people who want it implemented who are sitting on the United States Supreme Court. The fact that it wasn't a sweeping, every part of the ban will go into effect. They cut it down. There's a real dispute about what the what the scope of what is left of the ban is, but I think that in our work here, we believe that it will have its principal effect on refugees and on people attempting to visit the United States. We have asked for a clarification from the Trump administration as to how they will carry this out. We just did that today in concert with Muslim advocates and the Southern Poverty Law Center, because we do have our separate and independent case challenging the ban right here in the District of Columbia. So they did not have to do this. They did not have to go even this far. But I think it would be a mistake to assume that when the merits are argued, when it becomes clear in the court and the court of public opinion again in October, that this is designed to harm Muslims and to help Christians, and that that's a twofold problem with this effort on the part of Donald Trump to control immigration.
Right. It's amazing that so many lower courts responding to many different challenges, legal challenges to the Muslim ban, seem to come to one conclusion, which was that this Muslim ban was a Muslim ban because of the person who's pushing it, and in their own words, and that it was unconstitutional. And then the nation's highest court, which is supposed to be the, you know, most true to our Constitution, decided to completely upend this liberal justices, conservative justices altogether. On our program tomorrow, we're going to have an in-depth discussion about what exactly the partial implementation of this ban means. And we should remind ourselves that that it's only, it was meant to be a temporary thing after all. So let me ask you this, Barry, is it possible that the court is allowing Mr. Trump to have a win? Because by the time they take up the case, the 90 days or 120 days over which some parts of the ban were to be implemented will be over.
That's certainly possible. But again, this court kind of does what it wants. It ignores questions of whether a case is moot, and we can get into that in regard to the Trinity Lutheran case. But the truth is that there's a deep politicization of the United States Supreme Court. Donald Trump, when he was running, put forward 20 names of people that had been fully vetted by the ultra-conservative Heritage Foundation and other right-wing groups. And frankly, Neil Gorsuch was one of the worst people on that list, but certainly not the only one. In fact, I was asked recently, were there any people that could be characterized as moderates? And I said, frankly, there aren't any. These are hardcore, on-the-edge conservative justices. The good news from Monday, frankly, was that Justice Kennedy, who is a conservative but has not lost his common sense, has decided to stay on for at least one more term. In general, with one exception, if you want to announce your retirement from the Supreme Court, you do it on the very last day of the session. That was Monday, and Justice Kennedy is still with us.
Let's talk about the other case that the Supreme Court decided to hear, and this was the Colorado bakery case, where basically a bakery owner had refused service to a gay couple, didn't want to make their wedding cake. It's gone all the way to the Supreme Court. This has become a favored case for religious conservatives because they would like to be able to have the right to deny different Americans service based on how they feel at the moment, and then say that it was their religion that is preventing them from treating people equally. What does this signal to you, that the Supreme Court has decided to hear this case? And how much has the religious right invested in this case?
The religious right views this case as an enormously significant matter. Now, one of the reasons Justice Kennedy might turn out to be a person who saves the rights of this couple and people like this couple all over the country is that he has not, as I said earlier, not lost his common sense. Justice Kennedy does not like people to feel like second-class citizens in their own country. He, of course, wrote the opinion in the Obergefell case, which upheld the right of marriage equality throughout the United States, harshly criticized by the same religious right groups that are now trying to find a way to punish, to penalize couples who are within the LGBTQ community. Now, a couple things about this case that have kind of gotten lost in the shuffle. This was not actually a wedding cake. He was not being asked. The baker was not being asked to do that. This couple got married in Massachusetts, where it was legal at the time. It was not yet legal in the state of Colorado. And this was kind of an after party, a celebration of an event that had already occurred. But this baker claims that this is so central to what he believes that he couldn't possibly make a cake, even for a celebration that occurred days after a wedding in another state.
I wonder if he would apply the same standard to, say, you know, a Jewish family asking for a bar mitzvah cake, you know, and this person's not Jewish. You know what I mean?
Of course. Well, no, but my recollection is during the depositions, you know, when you get a chance as a lawyer to ask the other side questions, is before the trial even begins, this particular baker admitted that he had made a, quote, wedding cake for two dogs. So
wow.
All of a sudden now he's really concerned about this, the terrible disruption to marriage that is caused by two men getting married, but who conceded that he did this for dogs.
Right.
I mean, this is so insulting. It raises the question I'm frequently asked. Why don't we ever question the sincerity of the claims being made by these people who all of a sudden seem to have a profound interest in keeping somebody from doing something because they say, well, our religion forbids it? And that's a good question.
You know, Barry, I'm wondering if you can provide some historical context, because wasn't there a time when in this country you had businesses that served the public that discriminated on the basis of race? Of course, you know, black people weren't allowed to eat at the same tables as whites in many cities and
that's
states.
Right.
Did they invoke religion in that case as well, or was it something else? And didn't the subsequent court decision set a precedent for this case?
Well, what happened during the efforts to fight integration is there were lots of preachers on what were then big, powerful 50,000-watt radio stations in the country who were, among other things, citing the book of Genesis, and God separated the light from the darkness to prove that God's intended arrangement was for segregation of the races. Now, that is so absurd, but it was used all the time. Other Bible quotations were used. And eventually, this was, of course, repudiated. And we got on with the serious business of making sure that integration happened, notwithstanding these claims. I want to say one thing in support of the current Supreme Court. When they did look at questions like the infamous Hobby Lobby decision, they said that we're not making a decision about how this might affect other groups of people, but on race, we don't believe that a religious presumption, a religious statement, a quotation from the Christian Bible, that will not be allowed to trump racial justice in the country. So they have gotten that. Some of us think it's bizarre that this class of people are the only class of people this court will, with some degree of unanimity, say can't be affected by the religious views of others. But that the LGBT community, that single women, that lots of other groups that have been the beneficiaries of very little in this country, that they don't stand to assert their claims successfully. We're going to find out if in the case of the cake baker, he calls himself a cake artist. I'm sure he makes wonderful cakes, but it strikes me that his claim that this is some form of art is totally phony.
The Hobby Lobby case you were referring to was in the issue of contraception for female employees. Let's talk about the final case where the Supreme Court actually issued a ruling. This was in the case of Trinity Lutheran Church in Missouri. And this is an institution that would have been eligible for state funds to refurbish its playground that children use, except that because it was a religious organization, the so-called Blaine Amendments, which is the state level version in Missouri of the separation of church and state, made that church ineligible for those funds. The court said that doesn't matter, that because this playground was a non-religious part of the church's activities, that it can use state taxpayer funds. How does your organization come down on this ruling?
I mean, this was also a really terrible ruling. And although there is a footnote that says now the only thing we're deciding is whether a state that's giving out tires on playgrounds can exclude churches. And the majority said, no, of course they can't. A lot of justices didn't even accept the footnote. They agreed with the principle, but they didn't agree with this limitation on it. When you think about it, though, this portends very bad things, we think, for the future of funding. There are many things the federal government and the state governments can do. They can fund a large variety of things. They can celebrate holidays. But they can't fund religion. They can't promote it. This school playground, which was an integral part of the church itself, the Trinity Lutheran Church itself, uses the idea that it has a safe playground to lure parents into sending their children to this school. Hmm. So the idea
and we should say Betsy DeVos, the education department head, who's a big proponent of religious schools, is celebrating this decision, which should really scare people.
No, it certainly should. She should scare people alone because of the views she has had prior to this decision. But on this decision, it's all for this demonstrates, you know, the value of choice and we need to leave parents. My question for churches, as a person who is a minister and has pastored churches, one of the things I think people need to do in roles of authority is if they're your children that are potentially at risk in your church or on your church's playground, it's your responsibility to make it safe. It is not a good idea, a sensible, common sense idea to say, well, we don't really have the money right now. Let's get that money or let's get those shredded tires all rubberized and melted down from the state.
So
it's
Barry,
absurd.
I'm wondering if we were to replace church with mosque, if we were to replace the religion of the baker in Colorado from Christianity to Islam, how would the right view these cases?
Well, in theory, they might view them the same way, but I can guarantee you they would not be this dogged in their pursuit.
These are political issues, not religious issues.
No, they would say that, and of course, we've already seen this happen when that falsely acclaimed Ground Zero mosque, which was neither at Ground Zero nor a mosque, when they were attempting to build that, the same religious right people that claimed that churches were being discriminated against because they couldn't, they were barred by some zoning requirement, they didn't take up the cause of the mosques. They took or in this case, an Islamic center where there was worship going on. But, you know, they are hypocrites. There's nothing to say other than that. They care about religious freedom only if it affects their own members, other Christians. They are not interested in this sweeping idea. We have a dizzying level of religious freedom in this country for Christians, but not so much for religious people. And there's a very specific example. In Tennessee, there was a proposal about a year ago for school vouchers to go to private religious schools until one day one of the Republican people considering it said, well, now this wouldn't, we wouldn't have to send money vouchers to madrasas, would we? We wouldn't have to send it to those Islamic schools. And that literally, the whole deal fell apart. Appropriately that it fell apart, But disingenuously, it fell apart because somebody actually said, we can't just give this to Christian schools. We have to give it to all kinds of schools.
Right.
That was too much for the legislature in Tennessee, and that's why there's no Tennessee voucher plan today.
Right, and because, of course, the overarching ideology is that the United States is a Christian country, that a lot of these people are pushing
sure.
us have that ideology. Barry Lynn, thank you so much for shedding light on these issues and for joining us today.
Thank you. Anytime. Bye-bye.
My guest is Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.